It's Monday, and you know what time it is. There's a new episode of the Empowerment Hour podcast, and I am your host, Nancy Ruffin. Hope you guys had an amazing weekend. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you rested. I hope you did something just for you. We spend so much time giving of ourselves to others and not enough time feeding ourselves, nurturing ourselves, and just doing things that we want to do and saying no to the things that we don't want to do. So I hope that this weekend you had some time to do a little bit of what sets your soul on fire. Now, it is October, and today concludes Hispanic Heritage Month, right? It's been a really great month. Personally, for me, every month is Hispanic Heritage Month, but hey, in this country, we get the period from September 15th to October 15th, and so today officially ends this amazing month. For me, it was pretty good. I had an opportunity to go out to Cranford High School and speak with the students there about my Latinidad and how important my heritage is. That happened a couple of weeks ago. I think I might have mentioned it on another podcast. But in any case, October is also a month that is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and it's also Domestic Violence Abuse Awareness Month. And I figured, what better way to kind of honor and talk about domestic violence abuse than by inviting a guest who is not only a survivor, but she is a staunch advocate and activist. She's very vocal and transparent about her own experience with domestic violence, and she has dedicated her entire life to actually going out there and speaking with students, young adults, and women on domestic violence abuse, and pretty much kind of sharing her story. So this week's guest is April Hernandez Castillo. She is not only an activist, but she is also an actress. And she actually appeared in one of my favorite movies, and she'll go a bit into that when she introduces herself. But it really is interesting to see how many of us, you know, women, sometimes find ourselves in abusive relationships and we don't even realize that we're being abused, you know. And so April's story is really interesting because she did not fit the prototype or the description. And not that there really is one, right, for what a domestic violence victim or survivor looks like, because I think that domestic violence is something that can happen to anyone in any community, regardless of age, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation, gender, race, religion. I mean, it can happen to anyone, and we see it all the time. But I really wanted to have her on because I wanted to have someone, you know, come on the show and kind of bring awareness to this and to share her own story. But more importantly, I don't know if you guys have been paying attention to the news, but there was this young mother in Brooklyn. I believe her name was Sade. She's from Bushwick, I believe. And she was walking down the street, you know, with her mom. And I think the news reported it as her new boyfriend and her ex, whom she had an order of protection against, shot her to death, right? And so he shot her multiple times. She was pronounced dead by the time she arrived at the hospital. And this young girl, this young woman, leaves behind two young children of her own. And what was really heartbreaking for me when I watched this story on the news was that one of her family members were saying that they hadn't told her sons yet, or her children, because they did not know how to tell her kids that their mother was no longer coming back to them. And as a parent, that really, really hit home for me. And so I wanted to kind of shed light to this because I think it's something that we may not talk about often enough. And so we often wait 4 months, like October or, or domestic violence awareness, to talk about it. And I think that it's important for us to get in the habit of talking about it. We see what happened, you know, with Dr. Ford and the whole Kavanaugh fiasco. And I know that it's really hard to talk about any kind of abuse when we're experiencing it, but it really is important that when you're being abused, whether it's sexual abuse, whether it's domestic violence abuse, regardless of what it is, that you speak up because it's not your fault. And although you may feel shame, there's nothing that you need to be embarrassed about. And I think that the more we talk about it, the more that we empower women to talk about it, the more that we believe women when they talk about it, the more we are going to start seeing justice in these cases. You know, so this is just my small part in helping to spread awareness, in having the conversation, in continuing the dialogue. And I encourage you all, if any of you are in an abusive relationship, please seek help. There is help. If there isn't someone you trust in your inner circle that you can speak with or speak to, go to your local hospital, you know, seek out a therapist. I mean, if you want to talk to me, reach out to me, send me a message, send me a DM, whatever. I am not a therapist. I am not a professional, but I promise to listen to you and I promise to help connect you with those who are in a position, you know, to help you. But just don't suffer in silence. We have to learn to break the silence so that we can hold these perpetrators accountable for their actions and so that we can reclaim our power and our voice. And so without any further ado, here is my conversation with Ms. April Hernandez Castillo. Hope you guys enjoy it. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Empowerment Hour podcast. It's your girl, Nancy Ruffin. And this week, joining me on the show is a woman whose career I've been following for a while and not even realizing it until her and I connected on social media. And so it's like surreal for me to have her on because she's someone. There's a specific film that she appeared in that is one of my favorite films, especially because I am a writer. This film really spoke to me when it came out, you know, a few years ago. But in any case, in addition to that, she is also a spokesperson and advocate and activist for domestic violence abuse, which is really in line with the month of October, because we know that October is Domestic Violence Abuse Month. So I want you guys to join me in welcoming the amazing April Hernandez Castillo.
Hi. Hello, darling. Hello.
How are you? First of all, thank you for agreeing to be on the show. I know that we have been touching base with one another for I think the past 2 or 3 months. I think since August, I've been trying to get you on. And, you know, it's perfect timing. Here you are, October. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much. I know we've been trying to plan and it finally worked out and it was all God's timing. And I had to sneak away from the babies. So,
yeah. I know all about babies. Believe me, my whole life revolves around my children's schedule. So I absolutely get it. You know, so before we kind of get into, you know, the meat of the interview, I guess tell my listeners a little bit about who you are, some of the work that you've done, you know, as an actress, and some of the other work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Well, I'm most noted for my role in the movie Freedom Riders. I played the character of Ava. And that was alongside Oscar winner Hilary Swank. And I was SAG nominated on my work with the ensemble cast of Dexter, I've done a ton of television, from SVU, Law and Order, to Elementary, to Person of Interest, just to name a couple of shows. And that's the acting world. I wrote my first book, which is called Your Voice, Your Choice. And I'm currently producing and creating my first official film with my husband, with our company, Lion Chaser Films. So we've been shooting a documentary for a couple of years on a good friend of mine. And so that's our biggest project to finish for 2019.
Interesting. So I guess tell us a little bit about the documentary, and I guess how is it partnering and working with your husband?
Oh, Lord. You know, I mean, my husband and I, we've been together for 17 years, married 11. And it was always our dream to create just work that we wanted to see. We wanted to be our own bosses and not have to live up to anyone's expectations other than ours. And so my friend, his name is Joe Conzo. He is a legendary photographer. And the New York Times coined him as the man who took hip-hop's baby pictures. So he was there when hip-hop literally began in its like rawest form. You're talking about from graffiti to b-boying to DJing to emceeing. He caught all this on camera. Wow. And he was also an EMT, and he ran into the buildings on 9/11 and the building fell on top of him. So he's actually a survivor of that. And he was a friend of mine, and I was like, Joe, no one's ever told your story? And he's like, no. And I said, well, I'm going to tell your story. Yeah. And mind you, I've never shot a documentary before. I didn't even know what that looked like. I just knew I had a camera and I had a subject that I knew people would be interested in. And so we've been shooting that for about 5 years. And now I was just with him last night, and we are ready to finish this and go into post-production.
Wow. You know, it's so interesting. I've been thinking a lot lately about the concept of fear and how so many times we stop ourselves from, you know, doing the things that we want to do because we're afraid, right? We don't know what we're getting ourselves into. We've never done it before. We don't know what it takes or what it looks like. And, you know, for many people, that fear stops them dead in their tracks, and then they never do the thing that they want, you know, to do. How did you push, or how have you been able to push past that fear, which I'm sure you've had to face in other areas in your life? How do you push past it so that you don't let it stop you?
I think I've always done everything afraid. I don't know how not to do things afraid. Mm-hmm. And I think when you are an artist or you are a creative being, you work past it because you're like, if I don't create, it's that cliche of saying like, if I'm not creating, I'm dying. Right. And I just think that as creatives, we go into the place that is scary because that's where we are inspired the most.
Yes.
And so many tortured souls have created the most amazing art. And so for myself, when I became an actor, I never thought I would become an actor because that's not what I was brought up in. I played sports most of my life. And so I thought my life would be into athletics, into sports. And then I went into Hunter College and I walked into the chemistry class, and girl, that was the one thing I was afraid of that I was willing to walk away from. I said, oh no, this pretty face does not do chemistry. It was the one thing I was willing to admit that I was afraid of, because I was just horrible in science. And I just thought like, oh, I could just do nutrition and I didn't need science, but that's a lie. And then I walked into an acting class, and that's where I feel like my career found me. I wasn't looking for it. It literally just fell on my lap because it happened so rapidly.
Wow.
Taking an acting class, and then I just started doing theater, and I just, you know, that's before the internet, right? So
right.
You had to hustle. It was going to casting calls. It was just going anywhere that you knew that they would, you know, hire someone. And then I just from there, it just happened. Like within 2 years, I left school because I started getting roles and I was like, well, I'm not gonna, you know, give this up. And then that's where I landed, Freedom Writers. So it was within like 5 years where I landed my first big film.
So it's interesting because so many of us, or like you hear stories about people who say that they've always wanted to be whatever it is, right, that they are. And then I hear stories like yours. And it's interesting because I had someone not too long ago on the podcast who kind of said the same thing. She's a dancer. And it wasn't like something that she studied from really young. She got into dancing like at 19. And then at that point, she realized that that was her passion. Mm-hmm. And your story is similar in that way, because it's not something that you say you always wanted to do, but you kind of fell into. And then once you did, you were like, yes, this is it. And so what I'm trying to say is that sometimes we have to let kind of God move the pieces in our lives for us to discover what our passion is or what our purpose is. And so for a woman like yourself, you grew up in the Bronx, you're a Puerto Ricana. And I know that for many Latino parents, they don't push their children into the arts or into, you know, the creative space. They want their children to go into like a good field where they're secure, where they're going to have a good job and make, you know, stable money. How was that in your own family? Did you find that there was like a little pushback from your parents when they knew that you wanted to kind of go after acting?
You know, first, I think they were just concerned because, once again, like you said, growing up in a typical Latino home, I mean, I think we're all characters. I think Latino people are just all natural actors. We just don't get paid for it. Right. And so, but my mom and my dad knew who I was, right? They knew that once I made a decision, they saw how serious I was. And so I remember leaving school and my mom was like, well, honey, you need to work. Right. So I went and I worked for Robert Half International. That was my one and only corporate America job. And I remember like faxing things and I would walk through the office and I'd be like, I'm going to be famous one day. So you should take my photograph now. And they would just look at me and they would be like, okay, yeah, go fax that please. And I was like, I will do that only because you're asking me nicely. And I was just like so cocky, but I really didn't know if I was going to make it. I just knew that there was more.
Right.
I just knew growing up where I did, right. I grew up on 179th in Creston. And if you're not familiar with the Bronx back in the day before it's like the new hot place to live, I mean, it was pretty bad.
Yes.
It was insane. People, I mean, murder, you know, ran through the, so for somebody like myself to just say, there's more than this concrete jungle. Right. And I just remember being as a kid, I knew that there was more, even though my parents told me, but inside my soul, I would be like, there's more than this.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if people are born that way. I feel like I was born that way. I don't know if that's something that can be learned. I truly believe it can, but I also think that it's just in you. I think if you're that type of person to just say like, I don't want to stay here for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Well, I think a part of it is something that we're born with, but I think it's also something that can be learned or can be taught, because I think that comes from like having positive esteem and confidence in yourself, that understanding, even though you are born into a certain situation, that what you're born into does not have to dictate what your destiny is, that at some point you have control, right, over your life and of what you want to manifest for yourself. And it's really about making choices.
Yeah.
Deciding to either go for it or to stay where you're at.
Yes. Yeah. And I really wasn't, I was never really surrounded by people who told me that I couldn't do it. I've never really had that moment where somebody, I mean, I think one time, and that's when I decided to become a stand-up comedian. I was dating this guy, and I remember I was at the Poets Cafe downtown, the New Eurekan Poets Cafe, and there was a performer there, and I was like, I want to do that. I know I can do that.
Right.
And my boyfriend at the time, he was like, why would you want to do that? Like, you can't do that. And I said, watch me. Mm. And then I, like a year later, I performed in New York Comedy Club. And then for an entire year, I ran the circuit doing stand-up comedy.
Wow. That is another, I guess, thing on your resume.
Yes, I know. A lot of people don't know that. Well, one, there's no footage of me, and I wouldn't even... You know, girl, that's before I was saved and I was just ratchet.
Right.
But you know, but my husband is probably the only one who has tapes. But it was the most, you're talking about fear, you're talking about facing the biggest, the scariest thing ever. I think it was doing stand-up comedy. You know, to go up there and to try and attempt to make people laugh.
That is scary.
That don't know you.
Right.
And you're there and you're just praying that someone does laugh. Yeah. And I remember receiving my first laugh and it was invigorating. It was a high. It was something that I can't even really put into words unless you ever experience it for yourself. Yeah. Where you're like, wow, I can actually do this.
You know, it is, I'm just thinking about that, the concept of comedy. Cause I think that, first of all, like I'm not funny at all. My sister calls me the joke killer. She says I'm so corny. So I get how hard that is. And so the fact that you were able to, that you are a comedian and that you're good at it, honey, kudos to you because that that's one of, I think, the most difficult things to do. And it's like what you're saying, you're right. To make someone laugh is not easy, especially like on demand. You know what I mean? Like if you're, you're in a space and okay, you're up, now make me laugh. That is not the easiest thing to do.
And mind you, I had no concept of structure. I had no concept of how to write a joke. I didn't know that there is a rhythm to writing a joke. I just went on pure, raw, I'm Puerto Rican and I'm going to use everything that I can use in my arsenal. And like I said, it was great. And then I bombed one day and it was, I mean, I forgot all my jokes and it was bad because like all my friends were there because, you know, as a stand-up comedian, you need people to go and they need to just buy drinks.
Right.
And I couldn't remember anything. And I remember running out and I felt like I failed so bad and it really, really crippled my confidence. And I wish I had a coach or a mentor at that moment to say, it's gonna happen. You need to get back on stage, because after that I never got back on stage.
Wow.
So it's a thing for me that I learned years later of, you know, failing forward. How do you fail forward and still find that confidence? I didn't fail forward. I fell hard and I allowed it to completely take over that whole dream I had.
So would you attempt to do stand-up comedy again sometime in the future? Now that you know what you know and you have all this wisdom and more life experiences that I'm sure you can joke about.
Well, the funny thing is I feel like I do stand-up comedy or an act every time I speak. So it's sort of me. I've definitely redeemed myself because now I know the rhythm of a joke, and now I know how to make people laugh genuinely, by telling a story and not like pushing
the joke.
You know, forcing the joke. And although sometimes if I speak and I say a joke, someone might not get one thing, and then you know you say the same joke someone else, and it like kills. Right. So it's really your, you know, the context of people that you're speaking to, the audience. But I do know that stand-up comedy was God's plan. It was his way of saying, I need to see how crazy you are. Right. Because one day you're going to be speaking to the masses and comedy will be a platform. So I had no idea that God was preparing me.
You know, it's what I find interesting in your story is that, you know, given some of your history and, you know, some of the things that you went through in your past as a intimate partner, right? You experienced mm-hmm. violence in a relationship with an ex-boyfriend. And yes. the fact that you were able to still kind of tap into your own humor, that you can go out there and try to make other people laugh. Do you think that your experience in being a survivor helped that comedic part of your life?
Well, it had to, right? Because, I mean, when you're talking about intimate partner violence, if you're talking about, you know, sexual assault, I mean, it's probably one of the hardest things to ever talk about. Mm-hmm. And if you are a speaker or if you are an advocate, you know, and you're talking to kids, because my main audience is always, you know, either high school students, college students, and women. But if I'm doing a high school circuit, God forbid, just imagine if I was just like, not even add humor, just really talk about my abuse. It will be one, it would feel hopeless. And mm-hmm. that's not my message. And secondly, I just feel like I set it up where people don't even realize that I'm going to talk about this. And it's a metaphor, because when you first get abused, you don't realize that it's happening.
Interesting.
You understand? You're not ready for it. It's not something that you're prepared for. It's not, you know, because I was one of the strongest, confident, cocky young girls when I was in high school. And I was an athlete, so I was strong. Right. I lifted weights. I had a father and a mother, right? So I didn't come from the typical broken home.
Right.
My dad was very present to this day. He's my best friend. Right. So, wow, all of these aspects. I went to Catholic school. You know, we were tight with money, and we were, sometimes it felt like we were poor, but I wasn't out in the street.
Right.
And it was one of those situations where it happened to me. And it happened to me in a way where, I mean, he almost like ended my life, right? So I have to use comedy.
And so how old were you when this first started happening, or when you realized that you were in an abusive relationship?
So we started dating when I was around 16. So I want to say probably 6 months or 7 months into that, where things just got weird. And in the sense of, so sometimes it's not physical. Right away. It is slowly isolation. So these are tactics, just in case for your listeners who are going through it. This is language that they should know. So his tactics were isolating me. He was extremely introverted, but not in a cool way, like in a very, in a very way where he demanded all of my attention. Right. God only knows what would have happened if we had social media. He would have probably stalked me. I look at all these things. And so it happened like that. And then the initial hit when he first slapped me was in front of my parents' apartment. My parents were inside, and he and I were having like a heated discussion, and he just slapped me out of nowhere. And I was like, oh, okay. Did he just... You have this internal dialogue within about 5 to 10, 20 seconds, because it happens so fast, and your face goes numb, and you don't even, your body, your brain is saying one thing, your body is telling another, right? So it's like a boxer who gets punched in the chin. The first thing to go are the boxer's legs.
Right.
And then they fall, unless it's a straight knockout. And that's what it felt like.
So you're 16, you're probably what, a junior in high school?
I was a junior. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, how are you able to, I guess, withstand or deal with being a young woman, as you were so confident, so cocky, not exposed, right, to the normal things that when we hear of, you know, women who get abused are like, you did not fit like the description, right?
No, I did not.
What goes through a 16-year-old's head when they find themselves in this kind of in a relationship, and you've never had any experience with this? You've never seen it. You know, you mm-hmm. come from a loving home. What was like? How did you navigate through that? Because I mean, you stayed right for a while after. What were some of the coping mechanisms, I guess, that allowed you to stay?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, it's interesting because before that, I mean, both of my parents were addicts. And so I didn't know this until I was almost 20 years old.
Right.
But my parents would always say, stay away from drugs, stay away from drugs. And now I understand why. But one of the things that in my relationship we started to do was I started smoking weed. Mm. And so that was definitely something that suppressed right. everything. And then he was my first boyfriend intimately. Mm. I was a virgin when I was with him and I gave him my virginity. So that was another thing where the sex became part of yes. the coping.
Right.
And I don't think a lot of people talk about this where that's the place where you, for some, not all, because you can also have rape in a marriage or relationship. Right. But for my relationship, it was a way of feeling safe. Mm. It was a way of saying like, okay, this is the only time where we're actually not, like, I'm not scared of him.
Right.
And so, and then, I mean, I was emotionally and physically abused. So he would just always get into my head. And I don't know. I think I became a really good liar. I think right. I just lied about everything because of the shame, which is really this right. this drape that overcomes you. So people always wonder why someone who commits suicide, you know, they always say, well, if you're feeling this way, just reach out. As much as I want to say, because I've almost tried to take my life twice. So I've been on that side, that thought process of, as much as I do want to call out, your mind is saying something else.
Right.
So there's a chemical, there are imbalances, there are actual, you know, physiology, right? Or physical yeah. stuff that goes on into your brain that although you want to pick up a phone, your other side is saying, I'd rather not wake up.
And so how did you then, well, you're here, so thank God for that. That
yes, girl.
Attempts were
praise God.
Unsuccessful. Yes, praise God. Mm-hmm. How were you able then to get out of that space to get to a place of healing where then you see that life really is worth living? Despite everything that you had gone through, you know, the abuse and the pain and whatever other factors were contributing, you know, to you wanting to end your life, how did you evolve and grow and heal past that?
It really was that day where I contemplated taking my, you know, committing suicide. I woke up sure, for sure I was going to do it because the pain was just too much. And then the secrets and then hiding everything. And the abuse was just getting way, way, way more intense. And I myself now was becoming aggressive, which right. is another thing that I don't think people like to talk about because it's like, well, how could that happen? And it does happen. It's your coping. It's another coping mechanism of saying, you know what? I'm just going to attack you because I'm at that place right now. So I reached the point where I was no longer afraid of death, either through his hands or my own. And I just thought, well, if I do it myself, then at least I have control of that. He doesn't. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, I'm like about 19 and a half. This is all happening. So college for me wasn't the best experience because I was still in that relationship with him and I barely got through it. And so, but even high school was, you know, pretty bad. And I just got on my knees and I prayed. Mm. And I said, God, if you are real, I need you to save me because I'm not ready to die. I remember it. I can paint it for you if I could paint. I was in my room. And I remember what caused it, I had this mirror, you know, the cheap mirrors that we buy for like $5.
Yes.
It was shattered. It was shattered. And I couldn't recognize myself.
Wow.
I couldn't recognize who I was. Mm. And I was so mad, but I was so depressed. And I was like, I'm just gonna do it today. But when I got on my knees, I heard a voice. Obviously, it was God.
Right.
I heard two voices, actually. I heard a very dark voice, and I feel like it was God's voice for me. And he said, just get up. Simple.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think we complicate God.
Yes.
But God is actually, he can be very simple. And he can also be complicated. But when he wants to really get you, he can be so simple. And I remember I got up and I said, if you save me, I promise you that I will speak about this one day. Mm. And I won't stop. Wow. So that was a defining moment. And then I made the phone call to him. And I was like, I'm done. I broke up with him, and obviously it wasn't easy. He came into my home. He tried to force himself on me in my room while my parents are there. Mm. I'm fighting him in my room. My parents have no idea what's going on.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I guess so you were able to hide this from your parents like the whole time that it was happening, right?
Yes.
What did they say, or what did your family say when they first found out that you had been abused? You know, because now you're so vocal and you're out there and you're a spokesperson, you know, mm-hmm. for the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Mm-hmm. How did they first find out? And then what was that moment like?
I didn't share my story till 10 years later.
Wow.
Right. Wow. So when we're thinking of the whole case that just happened with Dr. Ford and Judge mm-hmm. Kavanaugh, where it took her 30 something years to say something, it took me 10. The only person that knew everything was my boyfriend, who's now my husband. He's mm-hmm. the only one. But when after Freedom Riders is when I realized I had my own story. And so when I moved back to New York, I started talking. It still wasn't, I didn't have a developed story. I just knew I wanted to say something. But it was in 2010 where I was like, I think I need to tell my parents, because before I tell anyone else.
Right.
And it was a summer night, and I brought my dad downstairs and I was like, I gotta talk to you. And he's like, what's up? And we were in front of the building where I grew up in, and I told him everything. And it was one of the most profound moments of my life with my dad. And he was just crying and I was crying. And of course that question, well, why did you stay? And why didn't you tell me? And my answer was, I was trying to protect you.
Mm.
Not
isn't that something though, right? When we think, isn't that something? Here you are 16, 17, 18, however, you know, those years where you were going through this, and in your mind mm-hmm. at that time, all you're thinking about is protecting your parents from the abuse that you were experiencing.
Yes. Well, I knew that my dad was a crazy Puerto Rican, and I'm his daughter, and my dad would go to the, you know, to the hounds, yes. the ends of the world and hell and come back.
To protect you. Absolutely.
And, you know, obviously with all the education and certifications and work that I've done, had my father retaliated, he would have ended up in jail.
Right.
Because unfortunately the law is not in favor of victims.
Right. But I mean, I still find it just very interesting that that was what you...
That was my thing. About. Yeah, I know. I don't know. It was just my way of also the shame, right? It's the one thing that keeps any person from speaking up.
Right. And it's
and the judgment. It's the judgment. It's the, you know, and I tell people, you need to get past the judgment, because people are going to judge you whether you like it or not.
Yep.
And it is what it is. You know, you just have to get to a place where you can get to healing. So that was the first time in 2010. And then from there, I just started really crafting my story. And then now it's evolved.
You know, and so now you're a person, you're a public figure, you're out there, you're in the media. Has your ex ever tried to reach out to you in any way?
No, thank God.
Thank God. Hallelujah.
He was in the industry. I do know, because we were dating and later into the last year or so, he began modeling, and he actually you know, he did very well for himself. He was in a couple of videos, music videos. I don't know where he went after that, but right. No, I don't know if he, I'm sure he's had to check my page because of social media. Like that's just, you know, and I mean, I did write a book about him, but I've never mentioned his name. Like no one, unless you're in my intimate circle, you know who he is. So, yeah.
So fast forward to present day, you're happily married. You have one daughter, right?
Two.
Okay. So you have two daughters. Mm-hmm. How do you as a survivor, and I mean, I guess for all of us parents, right, who have daughters, I guess, how do you ensure that your own daughters never find themselves in similar situations? Like how do we prepare our girls, right, for these relationships?
Well, we've obviously seen from my example that it can happen to anyone. Right. So it doesn't matter how much prepping you do, but I truly believe one of the other things other than God that never left me was the standard that I knew. Mm. So I saw that standard. I knew what love looked like. I knew what it felt like. And while I was getting hit or even after when I would be bruised, in my mind, I was like, this is not it.
Right.
And that was the one thing that kept me. And that's why I was able to make that decision. So I feel as parents, it is about setting a standard, a foundation for your children. Mm. The things that they should and should not accept. Right. Understanding that their voice is absolutely, I mean, my mom, she and I probably had the most complicated relationship. She was also abused as a child, and she, you know, she was abusive to me emotionally, right. Which is weird because she's the one who gave me my voice. And she would always tell me how powerful my voice was, and don't let anyone take that away, and no one can ever disrespect you. I think that even that little bit allowed me to leave. So just imagine if you're able to just have open conversations with your kids and talking about abuse. Now, if as a parent, if any parents are, you know, if they listen to this and they're deathly afraid, they don't know how to talk about it, man, there's so many websites that you can go on and say, you know what? Why don't we do this together? Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have that.
Right. So I guess what are some red flags parents can look for, right? Like
definitely. Number one, grades in school. Mm-hmm. And these are just flags for anything because it could be suicide. It could be a eating disorder.
Right.
But for me, the red flag definitely were my grades. They declined. I was an A student. I was on honors roll and they declined heavily. If they begin to isolate themselves, if the person that they're dating, you see how your children change when they're in front of them.
Right.
Those are very tangible signs. Yes. And I only say that because that's what happened to me.
Right.
Had my parents been more aware, then they would have been able to say, algo está pasando. You know, there's something going on here. So I definitely think of grades. Look at their body. And do not be afraid to invade your kid's room. Mm. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. We live in an age where we're like, no, you know, listen, there is no privacy in this house, honey.
I know.
Because I am paying the bills. That's right. And until you pay the bills, then you can lock your door. So my husband and I are very, very like, no, we're not going to have that. And not being afraid, I think if my parents would have invaded my room, they would have found everything.
Wow.
Now, how you approach your kids is a different story once you find out.
Right.
And I think,
so what would that look like? Because I think you want to make sure that you approach them in a way where they don't shut down, but that they feel like they can talk to you, right?
Yes. So I think, let's just say if you find tangible evidence, right? Let's just say you find evidence that your son or daughter are being sexually assaulted or molested or someone's being abused. First and foremost, breathe. Mm. We don't think about that.
Right.
We don't think that the moment when your adrenaline kicks in, you become your breath and the way you breathe becomes shallow.
Right.
Because your body goes into shock. Breathe and know that you have the ability to either bring them into the light or they run away.
Wow.
And so you sit with them and you tell them how much you love them. You remind them who they are. And you say, is there something that you would like to tell me? Or if you found something,
Right.
say, I found this. I didn't mean to find this,
Right.
but I'm your mom, I'm your dad, and I love you. Now, the kid might freak out, and it's only because they're afraid.
Right.
They might send you to hell, and it's only because they're afraid.
Girl, you schooling me right now. I'm taking all this in.
No. It's because we have, as parents, you know, we are the closest thing to God in the sense of, you know, God loves us so much
Yes.
that
That's how we love our kids.
that's how we should love our kids. But because we're human, right? We're not whole. We're not perfect. We have an emotion. So if you have an emotion, you don't allow your child to have an emotion because now they have to be there for you instead of you being there for them. You understand? So if my father is reacting, then God only knows what that's going to trigger. And it's so easy. It's so, you know, it's much easier said than done. But these are really real tactics. Just breathe. Maybe take a walk. Just know that, man, I have to have this conversation. And how, depending on how you begin, and that is always saying, I love you. If you find out your child is gay, I love you. You are more important than anything else.
You are giving me the chills, girl.
Girl, I'm getting chills right now. I want to cry. I'm all like, oh my gosh, because it's you know what it is. I've been on both ends, and I'm a parent now, and I'm raising two girls. And I think about all of this stuff, and I say, I will be an open book. I think you and I grew up in an era where it was speak no evil, hear no evil, see no evil. God forbid you question your parents.
You know, it's funny that you say that because I remember as a young girl, I must have been, I don't know, 8, 9, 10. I was really, really young. I grew up in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn was the equivalent of the Bronx when you grew up, right? And every summer there would be like this festival in our neighborhood, like, and everyone in the neighborhood would go, and you would get, it's like those Italian festivals. It's like the San Gennaros, but like smaller, like in the hood. And I remember us walking back from that festival. It was me, my mom, my aunt, which was her sister, and then like their cousin. And we're walking, and I don't know what happened, but my cousin ends up getting beat up by her then boyfriend or husband. I can't even remember what he was to her, but it was like he was her daughter's father, and he beat the crap out of her, like right in the middle of the street. And I remember seeing this, and in my mind, I'm like, well, why isn't like anyone helping her, right? Because you would think you see someone getting hurt, the first instinct is to help them. And I remember like my mother and my aunt saying, like, well, you don't get involved in, how do you say it in Spanish? Uno no se mete en cosa de matrimonio, right? So you don't get involved in marital issues or relationships. And I'm like, but he's beating the crap out of her. And they let it happen. And I remember witnessing this. And you're right in what you're saying, that you hear no evil, you see no, you know, we're raised to not say and to not speak and to just kind of internalize and be like, well, okay, as long as it's not affecting me.
Yes, well, it's also right, do as I say and not as I do, which is, if you think about it, it makes no sense. You're like, okay, people learn by seeing. Right, because my daughter, both of them, my daughter watches everything I do. She'll listen to me, but she's more impacted by what she sees. So it's a constant. She sees that in this home, how, you know, her father treats her mother. She understands that we kiss each other, we love each other, that this is a safe place. So she already has that foundation. Now, as she gets a little older, maybe when she's into middle school, I will have a hardcore conversation with her about what violence is, about what sexual assault is, because that's when it really begins. Right. In the sense of where kids, I mean, I speak to middle school not too often, but when I do, you are surprised at the stories. And you're like, what is going on in America right now that these kids are coming with stories that I don't even know how they're still alive?
Yeah, it's, I feel like kids today are under so much more pressure.
Yes.
I don't know if it's because of, you know, the internet, and I don't know if because there's more expectations of them, but like I see it, I have, you know, teenage nieces, and it's just like trying to navigate that social circle, right, of friends, I guess. I mean, I don't remember caring that much when I was in high school.
We never heard. Listen, I tell kids all the time, I'm like, I don't know what is going on with you guys, but if we had to fight somebody, we fought, and that was it. If I lost, they won, you kept it moving. If I got jumped, then I jumped you back, and then hopefully we will settle the beef. But I also just think, you know, sometimes I think we give too much power to social media.
Yeah.
It's like if, when we give too much power to the devil, right. I always, you know, I'm like, let's not give the devil all the power because he doesn't have that power. But at the end of the day, you are a parent. And you get to control as much as you can when your child is on that phone.
Right.
And so setting the standard or setting boundaries. So if you're on, if you have a phone by 8 o'clock, lock up the phones. They are in my room. I know so many kids that just are staying on the phone, you know, just absorbing all of this. Now you can't control what they do in school.
Right.
That's out of your control. But what happens at home, and if you're that parent that, you know, you just want to, you know, you want to take a mental break and you leave them on the phone, at the end of the day, that's your responsibility.
Right. Yep.
So my daughter, she'll go on the phone, but I'm constantly like, one, what are you watching? Second, you have 20 minutes. And she doesn't cry. She already knows.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. And if more parents were as involved, a lot of these things that we see happening with teenagers, we wouldn't be seeing. But it's almost like you said, you know, parents do, they're doing so much as well, right? That they do need that break. And so they figure, well, I'll just let my kid be on the phone and at least they're not bothering me, you know?
Yeah. Listen, when I was writing my book, I mean, my daughter was much younger. And if it wasn't for my phone or if it wasn't for TV, I had to do what I had to do. But there just comes a point where you're like, you know what? No, I can't allow a television or a phone. A phone is raising your child. Like, let's think about that concept. A phone is raising your child.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And then we wonder why kids have, you know, are experiencing the highest levels of anxiety ever. You know, God forbid you ask them to, you know, be a good student. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm so stressed out. I'm like, mama, talk to me when you're paying bills. Then we're talking about stress. I can't really, you know, but I get it. Like, I understand because I work with kids with so much. And so I try to be compassionate and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, I'm like, dude, this is your job.
Yeah.
Get with the program. This is your job when you're in high school. Stop complaining.
Well, I mean, it's funny because I have a six-year-old in first grade and she's complaining. I'm like, little girl, you have no clue what awaits you. She's complaining about homework and this. And I'm like, you're in first grade.
Yeah. So our daughters are both the same age. Yeah, she's once in a blue moon, she tries. And I shut it down so fast because I just go like, girl, first of all, you have 17 years of this. Get used to it.
Yes.
It is what it is. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, unless, you know, you're a prodigy child and you're going to become rich, then by all means. But that's not the case right now.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Oh my gosh, April, you have been such a breath of fresh air. You're just so full of wisdom.
Thank you.
I just thank you for being so transparent and so open and just so spot on with like your words of advice and encouragement and This has been such an honor for me to talk with you tonight. I just want to thank you for taking and making the time, because I know it's hard to carve out. We've been on this call for about almost an hour, and I think I've already exceeded the time that I said I would have you. But this conversation was so necessary, and I know that many of my listeners, you know, who tune in are parents, and I know that they're going to find a lot of value in what you shared and in some of the things that can kind of help them in their own relationships with their own children. Because parenting is not easy. This thing is hard.
Oh, my goodness. It is not easy.
But before I let you go, I want to just give you an opportunity to kind of let people know, you know, how they can find you, where they can connect, how they can buy your book, how they can book you if they want you to come out, you know, to a school or for an event or whatever. How can they get in touch with you?
The best way is through Instagram. It's my way of connecting with the world at April L. Fernandez, and it is I that runs my page, and they can leave me a DM. Even if
and that concludes this week's episode of the Empowerment Hour podcast. As April mentioned, you can catch up with her on her Instagram page at April L. Fernandez, and you can purchase her book, Your Voice, Your Choice, on Amazon.com. So until next time, mi gente, be kind to yourself, be kind to others, and go out there and crush those goals.